This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
The purpose of this program is not to prescribe a treatment to individuals. Listeners should consult their healthcare practitioner before attempting any treatment.
Good morning and welcome to Health Watch. I'm Dr. David Naiman, your host. Today's guest is Brenda Watson. Brenda Watson is a health practitioner who has focused her career on uncovering the links between overall health and digestive health. She's a New York Times bestselling author, a frequent health expert on national television, well known for her presentations on PBS. Brenda Watson is here today to talk about her new book and PBS special, Heart of Perfect Health, The Startling Truths About Heart Disease and the Power You Hold to Stop It. And it looks like we're getting Brenda Watson on the line still. So I'll just mention that if you miss any part of today or other interviews, you can find Health Watch now as a podcast on iTunes. If you just search for Health Watch in the podcast store, or you can search for my last name. And also, you can go to my website at drnaimon.com/healthwatch, and you can listen to this show or other shows archived and get that information, hear this show and hear previous shows, everything from Michael Pollan and Dean Ornish and Mark Bittman to local practitioners and otherwise. I think we have Brenda on the line. Brenda, welcome to Health Watch.
Thank you. Yes, I'm on the line now.
Great. It's good to have you here. So your background is in digestive health, and you're now writing a book on heart disease. And I don't think most people make the connection between the two, but there actually is quite a big connection between digestive health and cardiovascular health.
Right. My new book and PBS show that's out now is called Heart of Perfect Health. And it's the sixth PBS show that I've done, basically mostly always on digestive issues, digestive health. And so the correlation was very clear, as you well know, as things have evolved in the last 10 years, of the role that silent inflammation plays in, you know, cardiovascular disease, and knowing that a big part of silent inflammation comes from a condition called leaky gut.
So tell us a little bit about the way in which inflammation in the digestive tract would actually lead to an increased risk of a heart attack or stroke or high blood pressure.
Well, actually, there are three markers that you have silent inflammation, and I'll kind of go backwards on this and get to the gut. But if you have high cholesterol, if you have high blood pressure, if you have high sugar, fasting glucose levels, and if you have obesity or a lot of it, especially abdominal fat, those are markers, and those markers mean you have silent inflammation. Now, if you slammed your finger in a door and the finger swelled up, you would know you have acute inflammation because it would hurt. But what people don't realize is they're developing the process of silent inflammation. It's a precursor. So as these markers are going up, silent inflammation is developing in the body. High cholesterol and high blood pressure are signs of it. So how do you get there? Well, it starts in one major point in the body is in the gut. So you have a mucosal lining in your digestive tract all the way through the whole 30 feet. But in that mucosal lining, it sheds and rebuilds itself every 3 to 5 days. And it's like a screen on the window of your house. So once you've eaten food or taken supplements, they're digested, and the nutrients, vitamins and minerals, are supposed to enter your bloodstream. And that's how they feed the cells and tissues and organs of your body. What creates the condition of leaky gut that leads to inflammation is many different things, David, as you know. It's the poor diet, it's the high sugar, it's the repeated use of antibiotics, it's the overuse of ibuprofen, NSAIDs, it's the high amount of chemicals and toxins in our body. And so what happens is the good bacteria becomes destroyed and lessens, and this mucosal lining, that's your barrier, sheds away, and inflammation develops in the gut. And once that happens, inflammatory substances can enter your bloodstream, and that's what circulates through your body, creating inflammation. And when that occurs, your relationship to that, to heart disease, is, of course, you develop clogged arteries or atherosclerosis and other conditions. But the markers that that's going on in your body is when cholesterol is elevated.
It was interesting in your book, Brenda, that if you have chronic infections of any type, if you have chronic respiratory, urinary, or dental infections, for instance, that will increase your risk for cardiovascular disease going forward because of those inflammatory mediators circulating in your body from that inflammation elsewhere.
Right.
So if somebody doesn't yet have high blood pressure or high cholesterol or high blood sugar, they could still have silent inflammation. What are the ways in which someone could find out what their inflammatory levels are? Are there ways that listeners could assess their inflammation level?
Well, sir, yes. I mean, for one thing, you can assess your inflammation by, you can do, if you wanted to see if you have leaky gut, of course, you can do stool testing, which and urine testing, which shows if you have an intestinal permeability, we call it, in the gut. Again, your abdominal fat is going to be a big marker if you have, inflammatory problem going on in the body. But testing your inflammation in terms of, there's new testings out like NMRs and testing the particle size of cholesterol, and there's many ways now to test cholesterol differently than just a total cholesterol number, as you well know.
And also the inflammatory markers, C-reactive protein, you mentioned.
Oh, absolutely, yes. C-reactive protein is a big indicator of inflammatory processes going on in the body, for sure. Yes,
and you mentioned an interesting fact in Heart of Perfect Health that if someone has a high C-reactive protein, that is an indicator that they're more likely to develop high blood pressure later on,
which
is interesting. So it looks like there's some ways to do early monitoring intervention before you even have some of these outward signs.
Right, and there's good questions in the book, questions to ask your doctor, the new testing, like I was talking about, the NMRs on particle size. And there's just some, things that we need to be an educated patient, of course. If we're going to the doctor and getting these tests run, we need to know what to ask for. And I think, some of this is just, I'm a big advocate of being your own health advocate. So being an educated consumer when you go to the doctor. The other thing I think that's really elusive to people is, and one of the things that really brought this awareness to me about the markers and about, I had in the book, I talk about my husband's challenge with cholesterol for over a 10-year period, and he had just really high cholesterol. It would range sometimes from 500 to 800.
Wow, that is remarkably high.
It is remarkably high, and he could go to, we have a doctor who is more alternative, and go and he could, take the sugar out of his diet, take omega-3s, no statins. He would never take statins, but he would, within 4 to 5 weeks, he could get it back down. But what would happen is the whole diet would slowly go out the window. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Sugar would creep back in, which is the biggest factor in the diet. And I'm not talking just table sugar, I'm not talking just soda, but also carbohydrates. So over a period of time, he would get it back down and it would elevate again. And then one day, about 3 years ago, I said, when are you going to start? And he said, well, diet and exercise doesn't seem to work. And I said, it doesn't periodically. I can tell you that. It has to be a lifestyle. Come on.
Right.
So,
well, let me ask you about that. You mentioned cholesterol and your husband and then sugars. The paradigm that most people hear when they go to their conventional doctor is cholesterol is the main problem. Eat less fat. And your book really looks at the situation in a different way. So first of all, tell us why you don't think cholesterol is as much of the culprit as conventional medicine has thought previously, and also why your dietary recommendations are quite different.
Well, because when I, you know, looked at, went through the process with him and many other people on this diet and cholesterol, cholesterol is your helper. So if you look at cholesterol, 85% of cholesterol is produced in the liver, and 15% of cholesterol comes from your diet. Most people don't know that, David. They think that we're getting a lot of cholesterol from the food that we're eating. You see what I mean? So what happens in the body to elevate cholesterol is when cholesterol is your helper. So it's elevated because it's going to go to the part of the body that needs the help. That's got the inflammation, so to speak. So when cholesterol is elevated, it's a signal that somewhere in your body it's needing help. So you have the cholesterol that goes to that area, and then it recirculates back to the liver to be recycled. You see what I mean? So it's not that it's a bad guy. It's a good guy. And so it's trying to help you. So what I found out with him was that with the sugar feeding that cholesterol in the forms of carbs also, that we have a really wrong assumption in many cases in this country, because cholesterol is really being fed by the carbohydrates, not by the fats. The fats are not feeding the cholesterol. If you take people and put them on, you know, the good fats and lower the amount of sugar and carbs in their diet, immediately these cholesterol levels went down. His cholesterol level went from 486 to 172 in 6 weeks.
Well, it's certainly true that the science is starting to bear out the idea that if you restrict refined sugars and flours, mm-hmm. that you can have improved cardiac profiles
yes.
with lab tests. And that was something I think even 10 or 15 years ago was scoffed at, the idea that you could eat a diet that had less of the refined carbohydrates and had more fat could actually lower your cholesterol.
Yes, and one of the amazing people I interviewed in the book there, Heart of Perfect Health, is Dr. Bill Davis, who wrote the book Wheat Belly. And he's a preventive cardiologist. And I was just, you know, I've been a nutritionist for 20 years in the field of integrative medicine, had my own health clinics back in the 90s, and worked with many doctors in my clinics many years ago. And when I used to teach about gluten and wheat and, you know, refined carbohydrates, but, you know, it's been an uphill climb with the sort of the information we're fed by the food companies about the high grain, low fat diets. But when I interviewed Dr. Davis, and Dr. Davis has seen over and over and over in patient after patient after patient in his practice, where taking the levels of the wheat and all out of the diet, and then, you know, putting in quality protein, plenty of vegetables, a little amount of fruit, that the amazing results happened in his patients, thousands of patients.
In case you just tuned in, we're talking to New York Times bestselling author Brenda Watson about her new book and PBS special, Heart of Perfect Health. So one of the ways in which you address this, which is a way you can also address obesity, is you restrict people on how much of grains that they're consuming. But when you say low carbohydrate, you don't mean low dark green leafy vegetables, for instance, which
no.
are carbohydrates.
No. One of the things I've done in the book is try to get people to understand teaspoons of sugar, okay? So that was the program that I started working with a lot of the people that I started helping with the high blood pressure and high cholesterol was, okay, let's take this concept. If you have 7 liters of blood in your body, and it takes 1 teaspoon of sugar to be balanced, and in a day, you need 8 to 10 teaspoons of sugar in all of the food that you're eating to be normal. How do we get people to teaspoons of sugar? Well, if you look at any serving of fruit or vegetable, you can quickly get that information on how much sugar is actually in a serving of fruit or vegetables. And then what we did was we took all carbohydrates. So if you, for example, we have a formula. And really interesting, David, is as I was writing this book, the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal came out with a whole article about how the food companies were going to have to change the labeling in the next 5 years to reflect teaspoons of sugar in the serving, whether it's boxed pasta or what it is, because people here don't relate to carb grams. So that's the formula I've been working. So if you put someone on 8 to 10 teaspoons of sugar a day and you go into a grocery store and you look at a label, let's take the average pasta label. An average serving of pasta that the food company gives you on a box is 2 ounces. That is a little teeny bit. So if you take the total carb amount minus the fiber, which in the average pasta, it comes out to be about 40 grams of carbs. If you divide that by 5, you get the teaspoons of sugar in that serving. So, for example, the average serving of pasta for 2 ounces is 8 teaspoons of sugar.
So you'd already reached your daily limit with that small amount of pasta.
Right. One medium French fry at a fast food place is 11 teaspoons of sugar. And that's what our children are eating as well as adults. And that's why we're making more and more children that will develop heart disease earlier and earlier. But David, the people aren't getting that. They get the soda, I'm sure, and they get the, you know, I talk to people all the time. Lady was saying the other day, you know, the way I reduce sugar is I started looking at all these, like, actually healthy-looking juice drinks that you buy in a natural product store. You know, they're juice, she said. And I started looking on the label, and I was consuming so much sugar, I just cut those out and immediately lost 4 or 5 pounds.
Well, it's interesting, even, you know, in the nutrition debate and also in the cardiovascular diet debate, if you look at both extremes, the people who are going, say, like Dean Ornish for a very low-fat diet and people like Dr. Atkins who are going for a very low-carb diet, the one thing that everyone seems to agree on is that it's beneficial to reduce refined flours and sugars as a percentage of your total intake of food. That seems to be a consensus on both ends of the spectrum.
Yes. You're absolutely correct on that. And I think that, you know, if you look at, you know, some of the data on, like, for example, whole wheat, because you go, oh, it's whole wheat. And you look at some of the debate, you know, on that and looking at, okay, two pieces of whole wheat bread have 2 tablespoons of sugar or the same as a Snickers bar. So go eat a Snickers bar. Do you know what I mean? But people perceive those two slices of whole wheat bread as healthy. And I think getting people to understand that we need 8 to 10 teaspoons a day, and the average American on a good diet is getting 37, and on a poor diet that has a lot of fast food in it, it's probably getting around 86 teaspoons.
Well,
that is a lot.
You mentioned in the book also, especially for people who already have type 2 diabetes, that it's useful to do regular daily glucose monitoring where you're looking at your reaction to specific foods a couple hours after you eat. Can you explain that to listeners?
Yes,
because
that seems
even more useful and individualized.
Yes, the fasting glucose levels. Now, here's what was studied. Like, if you go to your doctor and you have a test and you get your fasting glucose level and it's in the morning and it's anywhere from probably 85 to 99, you're considered normal. And one of the reasons that I advocate testing yourself periodically before, you know, in between doctor visits and even maybe every week is the fact that they have found that if your fasting glucose levels stay over 85, not 99, over 85 long term, you're going to have heart disease. So this is the other little caveat where people aren't aware that they are consuming, I mean, that their blood sugar levels they're assuming are normal when in fact over 85 all the time is elevated and they're going to set themselves up for heart disease.
So let's move on in our final minutes, Brenda, and talk about your HOPE diet. So some of the things that you institute with most of your cardiac patients as treatment and prevention.
Well, I look at something from the diet perspective, which we've already talked about, is controlling the sugar and carb intake. But the real role is something I've called the HOPE formula, and it's getting high fiber, getting fiber into the diet. H stands for high fiber. Omegas is the probably the central role in the formula, omega-3 supplementation. And the other thing that I educate people on is, are you getting enough omega-3? If you look at the average consumer, if they're looking at taking an omega-3 supplements, they have to learn how to read the label. Because in most supplements, it'll say 1,000 milligrams of fish oil on the front of the label, but when you look at the actual omega-3, and remember, omega-3 is the one, it's what's really helping you with the silent inflammation. So if you look at, you know, 1,000 milligram capsule and 300 milligrams is omega-3, the other 700 milligrams is just saturated fat, so that's not really beneficial. And if you look at and all the cardiologists that I interviewed and everybody that I've worked with, we know that in prevention of heart disease, you need about 3,000 milligrams a day of omega-3, but in actual reversing heart disease, the preventive cardiologist wants you up to about 5,000 milligrams of omega-3.
And 5,000 milligrams of omega-3 isn't the same as 5,000 milligrams of fish oil.
You're exactly right.
It's actually quite a bit more to get that EPA and DHA fraction.
Right. So what you need to do is read your labels and understand if you get a 1,000 milligram capsule that has 1,000 milligrams of omega-3, then you're there. You can take three a day. So this is part of the education. Also with omega-3, I like for people to understand the IFOS, International Fish Oil Standard stamp of approval, means that it's third-party tested, so it has no contaminants. That's an important factor that sometimes the cardiologists say, they want to give you something prescription wise, but when you go to stores, if it has the IFOS certification, then that's a quality supplement.
And then in the P in the hope is probiotics, and you mentioned some really interesting things in Heart of Perfect Health about some preliminary research with probiotics, not only for inflammation but actually for lowering cholesterol.
Yes,
I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, and probiotics, of course, is the first sort of destructive thing, what's destructed in the gut first. So you get, rid of your friendly bacteria, negative bacteria takes over, that's where the inflammation starts. And probiotics, on your immunity are very important. But in managing inflammation, there's major data starting to support the management of inflammation. People don't realize a probiotic is a multivitamin for your gut. It's much more than just friendly bacteria. Immunity, managing inflammation, making vitamins B and K, digesting your foods. If you look at the full spectrum of a probiotic, everyone needs these every day because they're being destroyed simply by what we're drinking in our water, or we're getting antibiotics in a lot of the meats that we're consuming.
Yeah, more antibiotics in meats. I think it's something like, I don't know if this is correct, but I read something around 70, 80% of the antibiotics in the U.S.
Yeah.
are going to our animals.
Yes. Yeah.
That's incredible.
In their water.
Right. So, and let's talk about the last part of the HOPE diet is enzymes. What do you mean by enzymes, and what are they good for your patients?
Well, in enzymes, specifically digestive enzymes like protease, amylase, and lipase, which is protein digestion, starch digestion, and fat digestion, and that's a good preventive because if your digestion's compromised, then what happens to food in your digestive tract is it becomes more of a toxin producer, which also feeds the leaky gut and, the whole inflammatory process that goes on in the digestive tract. So just a digestive enzyme with your meals is very, very helpful.
And has there been any research on that around inflammation or heart outcomes at all?
Well, not so much, but I can tell you that we do watch people take enzymes and then do stool testing on them. And in our stool testing, if we run what's called a comprehensive stool analysis, what we see is in a pretest where we don't give them enzymes, we see they have undigested protein, starches, and fats in their stool. But once we give them enzymes for a period of 3 months and then we retest, we see that they're now digesting these foods. Now, there is another thing, David, that I will write more about in the future, and that is systemic enzymes. And that's something totally different than digestive enzymes in that these are enzymes you take on an empty stomach that begin to clean up the blood.
Well, so, before we end today, I just wanted to mention that one of the fun things about reading your book is it's got these great photographs and illustrations. These crazy images of, or drawings and illustrations of the insides of blood vessels and of fat cells. And it's very evocative and colorful to read the book.
Thank you. I'm a teacher with pictures.
Yeah, and then you also have a nice section on recipe and meal planning.
Yes,
with some pretty tasty looking foods.
Right, and that's the whole teaspoons of sugar. Every one of the recipes gives you the teaspoons of sugar per serving. And also in the back I have the graphs and charts of all the different foods and how much sugar's in them.
Well, we should mention in the final moment that you really stress at the beginning of the book that atherosclerosis is something that is actually not only preventable but reversible in some people.
Yes, actually it is, and that is something, like, it's never too late to start for anyone out there listening. One of the things I talk about in the show in the book is my father, who had triple bypass surgery and was on 17 medications, and at 70 years old decided to do something different, and within 3 or 4 months he was off all medication for diabetes, the whole thing. He was off of all medication and had lost 30 pounds and changed his life.
Well, do you have a website you can direct our listeners to?
Yeah, go to brendawatson.com. It's real easy.
And any other final thoughts for our listeners about Heart of Perfect Health?
No, I just encourage everyone to watch it and know that this is really easy. I always say, if my husband can do it, anyone can. But it is an easy thing to do. And once you feel better, and, you know, I've been in this for, like I said, well over 20 years, working in clinics, helping people. And I will tell you, once you start to feel better and you feel in control of your health, it just changes your whole life.
Well, it's a pleasure having you on Health Watch today, Brenda.
Thank you, David.
We're talking today with Brenda Watson, the author of the book and PBS special Heart of Perfect Health. If you missed part of today's interview or want to hear other archived Health Watch interviews, you can go to the iTunes podcast store and search for Health Watch, or you can go to my website, drnaiman.com/healthwatch. And next up is a show with Dr. Yolanda White about the negative effects of fluoridation on children.
KBOO Radio is a proud sponsor of the 23rd Cascade Festival of African Films, Africa Through African Lenses. The film festival will take place February 1st through March 2nd, 2013, Thursday through Saturdays each week. The majority of films were made by African directors and celebrate Africa's achievements, expose Africa's failures, and reveal the possibilities of change and a more hopeful future. More information on the Festival of African Films can be found at kbo.fm/cfaf23.
I face the barren waste without the taste of water, cool, clear water. Oh, Dan, can't you see the big green tree? Well, the water's running free, and it's waiting there for you and me. Water. Cool, clear water.
Keep him moving.
Oh, keep him moving, Dan. Don't you listen to him, Dan. He's a devil, not a man. And he sweats a burning sand with water. Oh, Dan, can't you see the big green tree? Well, the water's running free, and it's waiting there for you and me. Water. Cool,
Hello, and welcome to a special program. I am Joanne Hardesty, and if you are hearing my voice, you may be wondering, is it Thursday morning? And the answer is no. But I am here for a special program for you about fluoridated water. Is it a risk to Portland's kids? And I am honored to have here in the studio with me Dr. Yolanda White. Welcome to the studio, Dr. White.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here.
It is such a pleasure to have you here. And, you know, we only have a half hour. I'm so used to having an hour, so I'm just going to jump right in. You are a pediatrician, is that correct?
Yes, I am.
And you are a pediatrician in Atlanta?
Yes, throughout the whole Florida. Throughout the whole state of Georgia.
Georgia.
Yes,
right.
I've been in practice for 8 years.
For 8 years. And you have concerns about fluoridation in water.
Yes, I do.
And so let's just jump in. Why is this not a good idea for Portland's children?
Well, I think fluoride is good topically, but once you swallow it, you subject yourself to a number of systemic side effects.
So let me just say that in this community, I've heard like when the city council was deliberating on this issue, there are lots of organizations representing people of color, representing poor people that are coming out saying this is somehow going to be the savior for kids of color, for poor kids. And all of a sudden they're going to have, I guess, great teeth. Which is why we want to put this in our water. And how would you respond to that kind of rhetoric?
Well, I think the problem is that we're going to have a great amount of toxicity as well,
mm-hmm.
Especially for babies. And that's my main concern, is to help protect the babies. Mm-hmm. As a pediatrician, I protect all children.
Right.
But I find that babies who consume fluoridated water, consume formula, mm-hmm. that's been mixed with fluoridated water,